like this. The result? More music, more local news and interviews, and more innovative programming. And we're almost there financially, so we'll just need a little bit of your help. Did you know that you can become a sustaining monthly supporter for as little as 35 cents a day? You'll be making sure that Twin County-centered radio is on the airwaves, and your donation is tax-deductible. I not only host the Playing Favorite show on WGXE, but I'm also a sustaining monthly supporter. I wouldn't ask you to do anything I wouldn't do. Just log on to the WGXE.com.
Clap your hands, everybody, if you got what it takes. Because I'm Curtis Blow, and I want you to know that these are the birds.
You're listening to WGXC, Acra, 90.7 FM.
You've tuned in to WGXC during our winter pledge drive, and we want to thank so many folks for making donations already to WGXC. We want to thank Frederick in Manhattan, who went to WGXC.org/donate. Austin in Hudson called 518-697-7400, made a pledge to community radio. Karen in Philmont made a pledge to WGXC. Ken in Stone Ridge made a pledge to WGXC. Patrick in Queens made a pledge to WGXC.org/donate. William in Toronto, thank you so much for your pledge at WGXC.org/donate. Pam in Claverick, WGXC.org/donate. Amanda in Lanesville became a sustaining supporter at WGXC.org/donate. You can too. For just $5 a month or 17 cents a day, you can be a sustaining supporter at WGXC. We are 4/5 of the way to eliminating pledge drives almost completely at WGXC, making WGXC a sustainable station. We're only a few more folks away from doing that. You can put us over the top at WGXC.org/donate. Please help us today to keep community radio on tomorrow.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street. You belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of the Bridge Street Theater in Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Good morning, and welcome to Ginger Radio Hour. I'm Justin Maiman. You're listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM. Today on the show, Johanna Titus, locals. As always, we try to do our best here to interview locals. They're collectively known as the Catskill Geologist, and they write a weekly column, which I'll point you towards later. And today they're talking with me about all sorts of things. Rocks, plants, mountains around the Hudson Valley and the Catskills. But they're also talking about pictures, paintings, and the ways in which the Hudson Valley School of Art basically became a historical record in many ways of the landscape that we see around us up here. They're writing a new book all about that, and we're going to chat about that in a bit. You are listening, of course, to Mussorgsky. I can never say that right. The Russian composer wrote this, one of my favorite pieces, Pictures at an Exhibition, and I thought it was a perfect piece for today. I'll explain more why. More why? More and why. But let's keep listening, and I'll be back in a bit. Thank you. I first heard this piece, Pictures at an Exhibition, in 1999. I remember clearly discovering this, at least discovering it for myself. And I've listened to it consistently ever since. I thought it was perfect for today's show. I'll explain why in a bit. The piece, of course, is by the Russian composer Modest Mussorgsky. He composed it in 1874 for piano. But what you're hearing is Maurice Ravel's orchestration of it, which happened about 50 years later and helped to make it a popular orchestral piece. And the orchestra we're hearing is the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, recorded in April of 1976, conducted by Carlo Maria Giulini. So we're going to hear the whole piece in its entirety throughout today's Ginger Radio Hour. And in a moment, we're going to hear my conversation. It's a two-parter. You're going to hear both parts today with the invertebrate paleontologist Robert Titus and the biologist Johanna Titus. They've written pieces for weeks and weeks and months and years about the Catskills, the Catskill Mountains, and the geology and biology of this area. They've also written a bunch of books. One is called The Catskills in the Ice Age. Another is The Catskills, A Geological Guide. And they made me laugh a lot. They are true teachers in every sense of the word. And I look forward to sharing that with you in just a few minutes. You're listening to Ginger Radio Hour. I'm Justin. Let's listen to some more music.
Thank you.
We'll hear more Mussorgsky after our interview. So you're going to hear from Robert and Johanna Titus, the geologist and biologist couple who write The Catskill Geologist, which you can read every week at thecatskillgeologist.com. They've written books together. They're working on a new book, speaking of pictures at an exhibition, about the Hudson River School of Art and all of the landscapes that were painted. They're doing the field work. They're going to all these places in which painters painted and the things they looked at. And they're describing the geology and biology and plant life and mountains around these. I heard a talk a couple weeks ago at the Carey Institute in which they showed some slides and talked about the research they've done for the book. It's pretty fascinating. The book comes out next year. I'll make sure to talk more about it when it does. But to begin, I asked Robert and Johanna where it all began, where this interest came from. And you're going to hear first from Johanna, and let's get right to it. Here are the Catskill Zone, Robert and Johanna Titus.
Just let me tell you this to begin with. Our fascination with the Ice Age and glaciers comes about because a short distance from where we live, there is another town, and it's in Bergen County in New Jersey.
Where we grew up,
and it's called Glen Rock.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just Google Glen Rock, New Jersey, you will find out that the major feature there is this giant glacial erratic in the middle of the main street.
Mm-hmm.
So it separates north and south of the main street.
It's right, it's just east of the intersection.
Yep. So we grew up with that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was from a glacier.
Can you explain what a glacial erratic is or what it looks like?
It could be a pebble all the way up to something the size of a railroad car that has been carried for some distance by a glacier. And then as the glacier melted, it dropped out of that glacier.
You've probably been to Sunset Rock north of North Lake or Boulder Rock south of the old Mountain House
site.
Those
are glacial erratics.
Those are two very good glacial erratics.
How large is the one in Glen Rock?
It's
size
large.
Of a garage.
Yeah.
It's probably 20 feet tall and 30 feet from one end to the other.
Yeah.
It's got a monument to the World War II veterans on it and a flagpole in front of it. And my paper route went past it every day.
Well, so how long did it take both of you to figure out that that was more than just a rock or that it didn't just grow as a rock right in that spot?
We just always somehow
knew.
Yeah,
we always,
Yes, Johanna and I have both been scientists since we were early grammar school. We both had the calling when we were 6, 7 years old. And so we picked up knowledge of that sort so long ago, and it's almost as if we just were born knowing it. And I'm not being facetious. As scientists, we go back that far. I can remember finding my first fossil when I was 6 years old. And you remember exploring Goffle Brook Park.
Yeah,
the local brook through the local park fascinated Johanna with its biology. So we are born and bred scientists through and through. We encourage that in young people today.
Yeah.
Well, and I can see, I mean, your passion is clear. And I think it's a little bit like intoxicating when I hear you talk about your subjects. You're both very, very much natural teachers. And it made me think, I was thinking this morning about how scientists, one of the gifts, especially teaching scientists have, is this real passion for the subject that can bring a student in. And I still remember,
I was not a great college student, but I still remember my geology, intro to geology course at the University of Minnesota. That was one of the few courses that I went to every week. I really enjoyed, there were field trips, but I was also, because I had no background in it, it was a core science course I had to take. It was one of these courses in college that really stuck with me. Anyway, you two clearly have that natural gift.
What you just said doesn't surprise either one of us. It's a very free science. Geology is an intuitive science. You can, if you know the world around you, you can apply what you've learned in that class almost every day. And of course, with our columns, that's our strategy. We want to give people trained eyes. We want them to see the Catskill Mountains, the Hudson Valley, as it was in the geological past, and as it was, and they never knew that. It's so important for people to know that when they see a boulder, it probably was brought to where you see it by the glacier. And what a revelation that is, and what a wonderful thing it is to know that. And if you have children, to explain it to them, if you have grandchildren, to explain it to them. None of the other sciences, and we love all of the sciences, but none of the other sciences are quite as intuitive as is geology. Maybe biology is a close second.
Depends on what you're talking about. Biology is a big field.
Yeah, it is.
But yeah, and to, just to give people an idea that I'm not, I guess, what you would call strictly a biologist. I minored in environmental science in at the beginnings of environmental science that long ago. And so I also took geology. I took environmental geology and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So it's not like I don't know what he's talking about and he doesn't know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. We're, you know, and him being a paleontologist, he knows some biology also. So. And what we don't know, we fill in for each other.
Right. Yeah, we work to get very well together in that score. Johanna is one of the best book researchers I've ever met in my life. I'm a wonderful field geologist. You see how that works. She can search the literature and tell me about things that I found out in the woods. And it rounds it out so very nicely. And it makes for a good newspaper column.
I'm so glad you brought up the idea of all of us regular non-scientists being able to kind of notice landscapes or at least define them in a better way when we're walking through them. I'm curious if, so WGXC is the studio that I work in is in ACRA. I'm in Caro. My in-laws are in Perling. And I'm just curious whether there's any obvious landscapes that I'm walking by and not understanding exactly what they are.
By Bavarian Manor?
Yes. When you go downhill, let's suppose you're on Route 32 near Perling. Off to the east, frequently you'll see broad, very flat landscapes where Route 23 crosses 32. If you look to the east, the landscape is very flat, a little bit marshy. That is the bottom of a glacial lake. That flat surface is literally the bottom of a glacial lake. Stand there and look up about 60 feet into the air at noon when the sun is shining down. And in your mind's eye, in your imagination, you can see the wind blowing ripples across the water above you, the sunshine shining through those ripples. What a marvelous thing it is. That is a flat landscape. It should be dull. It should be boring. It should be absolutely uninteresting until you realize that your 2 feet are standing at the bottom of a lake. Isn't that wonderful?
How long ago did that lake go away?
Go away.
Oh, glug, glug, glug. About 13,000 years ago, it drained. Yeah.
Glug, glug, glug.
A little less.
Give a shake.
Yeah.
Glug, glug, glug. So 13,000 years ago, there was a glacial lake at the crossroads of the Catskills in Caro. So Robert and Johanna may have the perfect working and living and life partner relationship. I'm trying to figure out the best way to say all of this in one phrase. Anyway, they really blow me away. They work together, they live together, they eat together, and they take many, many, many walks. You'll see them. If you're on any trails here around the Catskills in the Hudson Valley, they're out there all the time. So they're now working together on this book. It's about the Hudson River School of Art and its Ice Age origins. Working title to come. Maybe that's the working title for now. So I asked them about the book and the inspirations for the book, and here's a bit of what they told me.
Looking at paintings.
Yeah. Both of us. And again, it's kind of one of those things you can't remember when it started. I can't remember when I wasn't passionate, really, about the Hudson River School of Art. Geologists all around the world love this school of art because it speaks to us. I've always felt that when I look at their paintings, that they looked into the landscape and saw the same sort of things that I looked into, and so I can't paint. But it comes from the heart, my heart, the way I think it came from their hearts. And I loved that art as far back as I can remember. Johanna, I believe you can say the same thing.
Mm-hmm. When I still lived in New Jersey, one of my favorite things to do was to go and have dim sum Chinese breakfast on Sunday morning and then off to the Met and go look at something in the Met. And the thing that attracted me most was the American wing. So I was sitting on the floor at the Met on Sunday mornings looking at Frederick Church or Thomas Cole and you know, just fascinated by their skill.
We would be hiking on the Rim Trail in Catterskill Clove, and she would point or I would point, and we would both say, Sanford Robinson Gifford painted that. And we would look again, and the next time we got there, we would bring a copy of the painting along, and we would hold that painting up, and we would look at that landscape, and they matched. And can you imagine how exciting that is? Or we'd go up to the top of Poets Ledge at the southeastern corner of Catterskill Clove and bring Gifford's painting that he did right there. And we would walk back and forth a little bit and say, and put our finger to the ground and say, this is where he sat when he sketched for this painting. And we would, that was 162 years ago. You wave your hand through space, and you know that it's passing through exactly where Sanford Robinson Gifford sat. You share his space, you can't share his time, but you can look at the landscape and see his art. We couldn't ignore that. We brought a lot of knowledge of the geology and a lot of knowledge of the art to North Lake, to the Catskill Mountains, and from there it just evolved. We've been very active at Alana and very active at Cedar Grove, the Thomas Cole House, for the last 20 years. And so it's just something that has grown within us. Our knowledge of the Catskills, our knowledge of the art have become a symbiosis in our life. And so it's just natural for us to be working on the book.
We came across several people at Cedar Grove at the Thomas Cole site who were looking for the mountain that Thomas Cole had painted in the background of his series Course of Empire. And they were telling us people had gone to Italy to look for this mountain and all over the place. And somebody thought it was the Rock of Gibraltar. And the series was being displayed at Fenimore art museum. So we went over there and we're sitting and looking at this series of paintings, five paintings, and in the background of each, there's a mountain. And I looked at the mountain and I looked at him and I looked at the mountain and I said, that's Roman's nose.
Yeah, I want to give her full credit for this. She okay. figured that out.
So I took my phone out and I Googled Roman's nose and I'm holding up my phone, looking at the mountain, looking at the painting, looking at, and the guard comes over and says, you can't take pictures here. And I said, I'm not taking a picture. Look, I'm just comparing this picture with that picture. Well, you can't take pictures here. I said, okay, fine.
We get into so much trouble all the time.
We do. The guard followed us around for the rest of the day.
The whole day he followed. He was 50 yeah. feet behind us, watching us.
It was like we were going to steal the Mona Lisa or something. But so we, you know, took this knowledge home with us and mm-hmm. looked at it again and again and again and said, it's got to be it. Mm-hmm. Looked up some information about Thomas Cole, found out he was in the area when he painted the series, just before he painted the series. And he had been traveling from Catskill to this guy's house in the town of Esperance. And the only way to get from there, from Catskill to there back then, was to go right through the middle of Middleburg. And that's where Roman's nose is. And so we got this all together, this information, and presented it at Cedar Grove at one of their Sunday salons. And no one has refuted it yet.
We thought we would catch hell over it, but nobody challenged us.
I mean, we're not art historians in the first place, so uh-oh. Yeah.
The thrill of discovery is something that is so commonplace to us. Johanna gets credit for figuring that out, but over the last 20 some odd years, over and over and over again, we've had aha moments.
Yeah.
Again, like seeing where Gifford painted in Catterskill Clove. What excitement that is when you, in a flash, make that recognition, make that discovery. Science is like that, and we're combining it with art to do the same thing. It is so much fun what we do. It really is. People, when they read our column, should always appreciate. And almost every time we write a column, it's about something that we've discovered when we've been out hiking around. And look at the column and read it that way and understand it, what we're doing.
Is the book finished?
It's coming along.
The first draft is.
Yeah,
sort of.
It's going faster than I thought it would. It's and a fun thing. Sometimes you just sit down and you find that everything is already in you. And all you have to do is move your fingers across the keyboard. And it almost like it writes itself. It's an experience. John Burroughs had always said, he finished an essay. He said, I didn't know I had it in me, but there it was. And we've had that experience as writers. We've shared that moment with John Burroughs.
Does the book have a title?
We're fighting. Most couples fight over money.
Oh, well.
Don't get us started on that one.
No, there's no set title yet.
No, it's been a difficult book okay. to come up with a title.
But generically, I can call it what your talk was called, right? It's like the book about the Hudson River School of Art and its Ice Age origins.
The book, the title that I think we both agree on, that we would love to use, is the Hudson River School of Art and its Ice Age origin. But that's not going to quite match what's in the book.
Yeah.
We're going to be doing a lot of landscape architecture in the book as well, which we haven't presented yet.
Can you explain to me a little bit more about what that means? What's landscape architecture?
A lot of the architects and some of the artists, like Frederick Church, in the 1800s, let's say the latter half of the 1800s, began trying to find the perfect view. They wanted to kind of frame a view with with plants, mostly with trees and things like that. And so they started making these planned views. And Frederick Church, when he was older, had arthritis, and it was very hard for him to paint. But he could go out on his property and he could make these planned views and really manipulate the landscape to his desire. And people up and down the Hudson Valley started doing this, so that you walk to some place like Montgomery Place or Wilderstein or any of the, and even Springwood, FDR's home, and you see the way they manipulated the landscape to make these views, to make it more beautiful in their eyes.
And what we've discovered is that it was the Ice Age that created the landscape that they worked with. For example, if you go to Springwood, Franklin Roosevelt's home, it sits upon a delta that was deposited in Glacial Lake Albany. And the deltas always have steep slopes in front of them. And that was where the Springwood got its view of the Hudson Valley. If you go to Olana, everybody here, probably everybody listening has been to Olana. If you go to the south porch and look to the south, you have that magnificent view of the Hudson Valley. What we discovered is that Church Hill that the Olana sits upon was sculpted by the passage of the ice. The view you're looking at when you're looking south was shaped, was sculpted by the passage of the Hudson Valley Glacier. And so our book, the second half of our book, is going to go to all of these classic landscape architecture estates in the Hudson Valley and talk about how the Ice Age created the landscape that the architects could build upon to develop their landscape architecture. And these were important architects back in the middle of the 19th century. Alexander Jackson Davis, is it?
Downing Davis.
And Downing and Davis and Frederick Church and Vaux, Calvert Vaux. Everything they designed in the Hudson Valley, we can visit and we can put together an Ice Age history of that estate. It's what an eye-opener it is. And it's something that nobody on the planet Earth, other than we and you now, know about.
And in between, we have little snippets of literature, too. Mm-hmm. Descriptions that people wrote, like Washington Irving and Fenimore Cooper.
James Fenimore Cooper.
And they describe places in the Catskills. And these are places that are places that were made by the Ice Age. Like Natty Bumppo.
Natty Bumppo.
The famous one.
He was asked, where's your favorite place in the Catskills? And he described the Mountain House site, the cliff at the Mountain House site, as it was long before there was a mountain house. And Natty Bumppo described going out to the edge of the cliff and looking to the north and looking to the south and seeing what he called all creation. Well, in our book, what we're going to do is go to that very spot and we're going to describe how the Hudson Valley Glacier came out of the north, down the Hudson Valley, scraped up against the eastern Catskills and created that cliff and that view. Almost a silly thing, but it happens to be true that this magnificent paragraph in one of James Fenimore book, Fenimore Cooper's book, has an Ice Age origin to it. Nobody else knows this. This is going to be an original book.
And the description of Sleepy Hollow in Rip Van Winkle.
Right. Of course, there was no such, Rip Van Winkle didn't exist. He couldn't have slept 20 years anywhere. But we can take you to a place which matches what is in the story so very closely. And it's conceivable that it might have been a place that inspired the writing of that story. That's a stretch, and we're not going to push it too far. But we, our point is that the landscape of the Catskills is glacial in origin, and it influenced the literature as well as the architecture and as well as the painting.
Even if people did not realize what had made that landscape they were describing.
Wow, I can't wait to read this. Can you give can you give me a hint about the Sleepy Hollow town?
It's not a town. It's a spot on the way up the mountain.
Have you been up the old mountain turnpike, the hike from the Hudson Valley or right to the Mountain House site? You've been on that trail where you get to the bend in the trail where the Rip Van Winkle house had once been. That matches very well where Rip Van Winkle slept. In fact, probably it was called the Rip Van Winkle house because
of that.
The legend was that this is where Rip had slept. And that's probably where it got its name and where it got its inspired the name. So indeed, we will be describing that location pretty carefully, actually, in our book.
I'm fascinated by that book because it's so strange in many ways. And, well, I don't want to get into that part, but hold on. But one of the things that I like about your interest in it is this strange idea of sleeping for two decades, and then he awakes and everything has changed, right, when he goes back to his town. It does bring me back to this kind of idea I had, and I'm hearing in a lot of the things you're talking about, which is the comparison between human time and geologic time. And what I love so much about the ways that you bring the two together is you take me in my normal human time and you bring me over to this glacial lake down the road and then ask me to, you know, to think back and picture this in my mind, go back 13,000 years or so.
In your mind's eye.
And it's really, people might think that it's hard to do, but it's not. It's really quite easy. You can sit on that same ledge at Pine Orchard where the Catskill Mountain House used to be and just look out and just fill that whole Hudson Valley that you're looking at with ice, you know, and it's kind of fun to do too.
This is Ginger Radio Hour. That was Robert and Johanna Titus. I call them the Catskills Detectives. They're all about discovery. So they're going to have this book coming out maybe this year, maybe next. I'll tell you all about it when it does come out. Maybe I'll get to talk to them again. I want to thank them for taking the time. It was the first time I had met them after hearing about them for years or seeing them give talks. I'm a volunteer here at WGXC, and one of the joys of my life presently is doing this show, Ginger Radio Hour, and meeting people like Robert and Johanna. If you haven't heard, it's the pledge drive to end all pledge drives. We're asking all of you in the community to become a monthly sustaining supporter. Become a part of the family. I am. I'm a volunteer, but I'm also a monthly sustaining supporter. Because I feel like I wanted to be an investor in community radio. And you should too. You can go to WGXC.org to donate and become a monthly sustaining supporter today. If enough of you come forward, we won't actually have to have pledge drives anymore.
So what does it mean to support community radio? Well, I'll tell you what it means here for Ginger Radio. It means hearing more from people in our community. So today, Robert and Johanna Titus. But here's who else you've met on this show. In no particular order, the Catskill artist Mark Swanson, the Catskills photographer Marissa Scheinfeld, painter Fern Apfel from Kinderhook, Beaverland writer Layla Phillip, who grew up here in the Hudson Valley, the incredible writer Lucy Sant, who is based in Kingston, pasta makers Scott Ketchum and Steve Gonzalez from Sfolini in Coxsackie, Allison Levy and Scott Serrano, who run and manage and plant at the Hortus Arboretum and Botanical Garden. Man, this list is so long. I'm going to keep going. Woodstock journalist and my dear friend Carol Zimmer. Catskills writer and naturalist Leslie Sharp. One of our first interviews, actually, on this show. CAS founder, the Catskill Animal Sanctuary founder, Kathy Stevens. She and I sat down in a field with goats and did an interview for this show. Artist and writer, and my new friend, Javi Brock. He's from Neversink. Man, keeps going. Wildlife conservation photographer, Carla Rhodes. She and I talked about all sorts of things, including her bird feeder series and our shared love of condiments like mustard. Writer Peter Matheson Wheelwright, who wrote, whose novel actually was in part inspired by some of the writing that Robert Titus has done over the years. I didn't even tell Robert that. I hope he knows. Man, it's a big circle, right? It's all coming around. Who else? Poet Cornelius Eady. That was a delight. Who wrote one of my favorite poems about Cairo. And also has a house, had a house in Accra. Last summer, I got a chance to sit on my porch and do a Zoom interview for an hour and a half or so with the band Florist, who are based all around the Catskills, but mainly in Palinville. And the list goes on, but I'm running out of time, and I want you to hear more music. But I tell you all these names. By the way, go to Ginger Radio Hour on our website, wgxc.org. You can listen to all of those people here over the past year and a half or so in the Ginger Radio Hour archives. Anyway, I'm telling you about all these people and about this show that I really enjoy doing, because all you have to do to support this is become a sustaining monthly supporter. You do that by going to wgxc.org/donate. You can give $5 a month. You can give $10, $15. I even saw a field on there for $300 a month, which sounds very generous. All of that will continue to support this radio station and allow people like me, volunteers, to continue to talking to people like you. So that's the pitch. I think it's a pretty easy one. You can donate right now at wgxc.org/donate. You've been listening to Ginger Radio Hour on WGXC 90.7 FM. I'm going to finally stop speaking so that we can hear the rest of Mussorgsky Pictures at an Exhibition. This is the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, recorded in April 1976, and a fitting piece for today's chat with Robert and Johanna Titus. Thank you again to them. Thank you to all of you. Keep listening. Keep supporting WGXC. And here's some more music.